The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. And they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com, TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
The following program is a Podcast1.com production.
He's a world champion wrestler, best-selling author, actor, and lead singer of Fozzy. Now he's rocking the podcast world. This is Talk Is Jericho. Talk Is Jericho, starring Chris Jericho.
Welcome to Talk Is Jericho. I am Chris Jericho. This is the Pod of Thunder and Rock and Roll. Glad to have you with us again this week. Huge show. Chavo Guerrero, my old riding partner, one of the gang that I used to hang with in WCW days and also into WWE, along with Dean Malenko, Eddie Guerrero, Chris Benoit, myself, Rey Mysterio. It was kind of our little club. And I'm so excited to have Chavo here. And believe me, we have a lot of deep thoughts, a lot of stuff to talk about over the next couple of shows. It's going to be massive. It's going to be huge. I'm very, very excited about it, and I know you will be too. Lots of amazing, introspective, emotional information. But Jericho-holics, it's good to have you here. How the hell are you? Did you have a good week, huh? Did you have lots of fun? Good weekend, did you? Huh? Good weekend? I know Super Bowl 48, which it took me a while to figure out exactly what the Roman numerals were. I was watching half the game thinking it was Super Bowl 58 until I realized that my Roman numeral skills are poor at best. So Super Bowl 48, and everybody's talking about it. 111 million people watching the show. Lots of controversial things going on. The game was pretty lame. Denver got destroyed. Oh, well. It's one of those things you feel so bad when there's like 20 minutes left of the game and they're losing by like 40 points and you just want it to end. You feel so bad. But of course, like for me, like I'm a marginal football fan. I watch the Super Bowl for the commercials and for the halftime show. Okay. So the commercials this year, like they're kind of lame for the most part. I did like the 80s Radio Shack commercial, which is pretty funny. Like just Radio Shack, that does seem like so out of touch, very archaic. And I guess the word radio is one, but just Shack. It just sounds like so piss poor. I'm going to go to Radio Shack. They should have called it Radio Palace, Radio Emporium, Radio Regatta. That would have been nice. The Radio Regatta. Go down there and buy some batteries for your watch. But then they had this, if you saw it, you know that they had like Hogan was in it and Sergeant Slaughter and the California Raisins. Kid and Play. Always nice to see Kid and Play on my TV screen in 2014. That was cool. Jason, Chucky. So it was a real kind of an 80s homage, and also featuring Loverboy working for the weekend, which at this point has become kind of the ipso facto anthem for the 80s. And I think it's because of one thing, the opening cowbell. Anytime you hear cowbell, you think party. Cowbell is like the mullet of musical instruments. It's business in front. It looks like very business-like, but party in the back. As soon as you hear that, that rules. My very own cowbell. They should have got Loverboy to play the halftime show. People be going, why the hell are Loverboy playing? And then you'd hear the and people would just go nuts. 90,000 people jumping up and down, freaking out. So that was the winner of the commercial. I loved it. It was very, very cool. I also liked the Bud commercial where the guy was unsuspectingly picked up and then he ended up playing table tennis with Arnold Schwarzenegger, who was wearing Stuart Copeland short shorts, and for some reason, a wig. Not exactly too sure why, and nor do I care. I loved it. It was great. But then the halftime show of Bruno Mars, which I think Bruno Mars is so rad. I think he's so good. And I made the comment on Twitter that he is picking up and carrying the torch where Michael Jackson and James Brown left off. Started this huge controversy where people were like, he'll never be Michael Jackson. He'll never be James Brown. I didn't say that. There's only one James Brown. There's only one Michael Jackson. What I'm saying is he's carrying the torch and picking up the spirit of those guys. He's a singer, a dancer. When he started doing them James Brown shuffling moves, he's got kind of the Michael vibe to him. He can never replace those guys, but he's the closest thing we have in this day and age. And I think he made a lot of fans. Like, I like Bruno Mars, but actually seeing him perform with his band and, you know, he's got the guy on the trombone. I mean, when I was a kid, I started off by taking guitar lessons and then stopped that and took over trombone. And people were laughing at me like, why did you... I don't know why I quit guitar lessons and started on trombone. It's not like there was a gaggle of chicks hanging around that were into brass instruments or something. I don't know. I really don't know why I picked up the trombone and put down the guitar. I could have been the next Eddie Van Halen. You never know. Instead, I picked up this, you know, so-called dead-end rock and roll instrument. But if I had continued that, I could have been in Bruno Mars's band. I could have played at the Super Bowl. But unfortunately, alas, I did not. But I did enjoy Bruno Mars. I enjoyed the Chili Peppers, and then I found out that they didn't have their guitars plugged in. It's the big controversy right now that Flea's guitar, his bass guitar, was not plugged in. I didn't notice during the show. I did remember thinking, wow, these guys are really moving around and going nuts. And as a player, it's hard to go nuts and move around and freak out and play the right notes. But if you're not plugged in, you don't have to worry about it. So maybe that's the reason why they're going so nuts. Maybe Bruno Mars's band actually played the guitar and the drums, or the guitar and the bass for the Peppers, and they were just unplugged so they could freak out. I know Anthony was singing and Chad Smith was playing drums, but unless they have some kind of weird, like, remote control signal that allowed their instruments to be plugged in, they were not plugged in. But still, whatever. It was fun. I enjoyed it. It was a good halftime experience. And maybe think about, like, what other halftime shows has there been? And there's been halftime shows ever since the 60s and 70s, but it's only been over the last 20 years or so that it's become a real big kind of a rock and roll band. Like, who's going to do it? Some kind of a pop artist or rock band? Like, if you go back to the 70s, you know, you're having, like, this university state bands and, you know, that sort of thing. And it's kind of went all the way through the 80s. Like, you know, pick a year. Give me a year. 87. All right? The theme was a salute to Hollywood, and the performers were George Burns, Mickey Rooney, and the Grambling State University Marching Band. Can you imagine if they announced for 2015, Mickey Rooney is doing the halftime show? Mickey Rooney. It's like, I remember him as Bill, like playing the mentally handicapped guy, Bill. All right, so let's move forward to 1989. It was a Bebop Bamboozled in 3D featuring Elvis Presto. Yes, Elvis Presto, who was a Elvis Presley imitator. And he did some Elvis tunes and then did an audience participation card trick. Sounds like something you see in the CFL halftime. This year's halftime show for the CFL had one guy on a skidoo jumping off ramps and then driving around to the other side and jumping off ramps again. So that's what the CFL can afford. But apparently in 89, the NFL is doing card tricks. And I'm looking at this online as we go. Okay, 91, New Kids on the Block. And Warren Moon was in the halftime show. New Kids did Step by Step and This One's for the Children and ended up with It's a Small World After All. Yeah, vomit inducing. And then suddenly in 93, finally, Michael Jackson came and did, I remember, the super rad Super Bowl appearance. It was so good. I remember he started with Jam and Billie Jean, and he did Black or White, and then ended off with, like, all the children singing. It was like, probably the best Super Bowl halftime show to this day, but also the first of having the real big band, you know? And then the next year, they went to Rockin' Country Sunday with Clint Back, Tanya Tucker, Travis Tritt, and the Judds. Like, talk about a letdown. Michael Jackson to the Judds. How about in 95 when Indiana Jones was in the Super Bowl halftime show? Yeah, exactly. Indiana Jones and the Temple of the Forbidden Eye, Patti LaBelle, Indiana Jones, and Marion Ravenwood. Who was booking this stuff? And then you had Diana Ross, that's okay. The Blues Brothers in 87? The Blues Brothers were the halftime show in 1987. Not the best call I've ever heard in my life. Like, Boys to Men and Chaka Khan, Gloria Estefan, just basically kind of like cabaret performers. Enrique Iglesias, yeah, Tina Turner, I mean, she's all right, but as a, you know. And then they finally, listen to this one, the Kings of Rock and Pop. Now, this kind of got a little bit, remember when Aerosmith did it with Britney Spears, and they're all singing Walk This Way at the end? That was cool, except for Ben Stiller, Adam Sandler, and Chris Rock were in that one. See, it's very hodgepodge type of a thing. And then, of course, then you had U2, which was amazing. I remember that one. You know, then Shania Twain and Sting. Yeah, I guess they're kind of just trying to do different mashups. And then they had the famous wardrobe malfunction. I mean, at least you got to see Janet Jackson's tit that year. That's got to be worth something, right? And then it was McCartney and the Stones and Bruce Springsteen and Prince. Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers in 08. Not really a Super Bowl-worthy band, in my opinion. Another strange one was The Who in 2010. Kind of an interesting choice, but I guess they're kind of going for the classic rock type vibe. And then, of course, you had Black Eyed Peas. The coolest thing about that was Slash's studded top hat. Madonna, she was involved. I remember that one was pretty good. And then last year, Beyonce, she was lip-syncing like a mofo. Worst lip-syncing ever, but at least her guitar player was plugged in, unlike the Chili Peppers this year. But it was still very, very rocking. So even though the Super Bowl was a stinker, I'm going to give it a big the actual game gets a but the halftime show gets a yay! All right, we got Chavo Guerrero coming up.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Welcome to Talk is Jericho. In the studio right now, my brother, Putillo Falso. Chavo Guerrero is here, man. It's good to see you.
Hey, you too, man. Great being here and seeing on a different venue with you. You know, it's not like a wrestling. It's not,
I know,
backstage.
Man. Or a car or a van. Or
yeah.
We traveled together for many years. From probably, I started in WCW in 96.
That's when I started.
And you had just started
I started like a week before you.
Yeah, and it was funny because I remember, obviously I knew Eddie for years. Right. And Eddie's was your uncle. But basically you guys were brothers.
Right,
close to the same age.
3 years difference, so yeah.
3 years difference, yeah. And I remember Eddie was always telling me about his nephew, Chavo. So when he said nephew, like I just always would have this like, you know, vision of a little guy, you know, with a lollipop or something like that, my nephew Chavo. And then I remember you were one of the first guys, hey man, I'm Chavo, how you doing? I'm like, oh, I like this guy already. Because we were kind of in the same boat. Like, obviously, I knew Eddie for a while. I knew Chris Benoit for a while. So those were the kind of the guys I gravitated to. And then you, obviously, being Eddie's family, also were together with Eddie and Chris. And then Dean was involved with Eddie and Chris. And I'd never met him, so I met him too. So that was kind of our gang.
Yeah.
You, me, Eddie, Chris, and Dean.
Yep.
Couple other guys sometimes.
Fit being there, Regal in the
year. Regal,
sure.
When Oscar Mysterio came in, he was in there. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of like the gang that we had. Yeah. That was our club.
Yeah. Hulk Hogan hang out with us all the time.
It was funny in WCW how it was, eh? Like it was, it was real levels there.
Oh, it was definitely the hierarchy. You know, there was the top five guys or eight guys, whatever it was. And, you know, we would not even when we would not work with them, we really wouldn't even talk to them.
Yeah, or even see them.
Yeah, yeah. And then there was the middle guys, and, you know, then there was kind of us, so we kind of worked our ways up, you know. But if you look back in WCW, I don't know if everybody would listen to our wrestling fans, we went from being the guys that the unsung heroes, you know, because at that time, wrestling was changing, and you know, the cruiserweights were coming in, and with the difference of the style definitely changed, and we were definitely part of that style, and always wanting more. We were the hungry ones. We were the young lions, if you mm-hmm. want to call it, and we wanted, you know, to that recognition. We wanted to get more. We wanted to be a bigger part of the company and work with these, you know, these all top guys, Savage and the Nashes and the Halls and stuff, but they wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't have nothing to do with us.
I always kind of said it was like the Indian caste system, where wherever you came in right. is where you stayed.
For sure.
Because WCW wasn't based on... When you went to the WWE, you get paid on where you were on the show. Your guarantee was what it was, but if you're working the main event, you get a bigger percentage right. of the check.
Yeah.
In WCW, it didn't matter where you were. You could be in the first match, you could be in the last match, and whatever you were making, what your salary was, is what yeah. you got. No bonuses.
Yeah, yeah.
So we came in at a certain level, and we were always there. And like you said, I always felt that even though there was the big ratings war and Monday Night Wars,
right.
that while WWE had the better main events,
yeah.
their undercard was crap.
Absolutely.
WCW had crappy main events, but yeah. the undercard was amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. The undercard, that's what I get from the fans that remember back then, that always talk to me and say, God, the Cruiserweights, that's why we watched WCW. We watched them for you guys, mm-hmm, you know, for mm-hmm. the Rey Mysterios, the Eddie Guerreros, the Chris Benoits, the Chris Jerichos, the Dean Malenkos.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, exactly. It's like I would take just as much credit as the NWO for why WCW was so big at
Absolutely.
The start.
Yeah,
you know?
For sure.
But it was fun. So anyways, when I first came in, automatically was with all you guys.
Right.
And we used to travel. This is so funny to think about it. We'd go from town to town in a 6-person or 8-person van.
Yeah.
And it was you, me, Chris, Eddie, and Dean.
Yeah. And we've seen the best of each other, and we've seen the worst of each yeah. other. Chris and I, we've known each other so long. We've roomed together, and we've loved each other and cried to each other, and we've hated each other too, you know? So
everything in between. Yeah, yeah, it was funny because, like you said, you get on each other's nerves. Like when you spend so much time together, I remember getting in a fight with Eddie in a Denny's.
Yeah.
Because I just got mad at him. I can't remember if he was drunk or what, but he was complaining about the steak isn't cooked properly. And then she brought it back. The steak is too cooked.
Yeah, yeah, I remember it.
And there's like,
I'm not gonna eat it because she's spitting it. I know she's spitting it. We're like, Eddie, she didn't spit in it.
And I said that to him, and it was like, you know, we called him Eddie the Giant when he drank.
Oh, you feeling froggy?
Are you feeling froggy? Why don't you jump? Why don't you jump? Yeah. And so I jumped, and we ended up getting in a fight where I remember we were kind of rolling underneath people's chairs at the table at Denny's, and you know, like that's kind of the way it was at that time, because we were together always.
Yeah,
you know, I remember you and Eddie getting into huge fights.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, how was that for you? Because I mean, obviously, you know, Eddie is your, you know, he's basically
your brother.
He's your brother.
Sure.
But then, you know, you're trying to make your way up the ladder, and he's kind of at a certain level, and he's trying to help you. But you guys both got such hot tempers.
Yeah, you know what? It was great, and it was. Hard, but it was great. You know, we never, and this is the truth, Eddie and I never laid a hand on each other.
Mm-hmm.
You'd think that we did many times, but we didn't. We were bent in each other's face, and it was just like, you touch first, you go first. No, you go first. There was just too much love there. We never actually touched each other, but we'd be nose to nose saying, you know, F-bombs and, but then, you know, an hour later, we'd be hugging each other and say, hey, I love you, man. Okay, I'm sorry. Okay. It's just growing pains, you know. He's at his spot, and you know, he's protecting his spot, and I'm at my spot trying to get to them.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think I know more than I do, you don't. He thinks, you know, you start coming up. It's just, you know, growing pains.
I remember that you used to have to wear a shirt that said Uncle Eddie Knows Best or something.
This is it. So we're in Panama City.
I
just told this story on a different interview.
At Club La Vila, where the nightclub, we had a wrestling show at a nightclub where the ring was in the middle of the swimming pool.
Yeah, yeah.
And so all day long, we were just hanging out on the beach and, like, you know, hanging out, drinking, whatever we're doing. Yeah. So by the time the show comes around, you're already half nuts anyways.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was the best time, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So one of the, I believe, remember Colin, who's the English photographer?
Yes, the magazine.
Yeah, yeah. He came back and he went to some little rinky-dink store in Panama City and came back like, hey, I got a good idea. Me and Eddie were doing this storyline to where he was he's a bad guy and I was a good guy, and we had a match, and whoever won, the person either had to, you know, he had to turn good, and or I had to turn bad. Well, of course he won, and now
you had to be his slave or his minion.
I had to do what he said and turn on people and be just a bad guy, you know, and I rebelled against it, and I was starting to go a little crazy. And so Colin shows up and goes, hey, I got this idea. Here's a shirt, and it says, Eddie Guerrero is my favorite wrestler. And I say, Eddie, like, made me wear it. It was, like, airbrushed, you know, total, like.
It was so cheesy.
It was just cheesy. Something you just got, like, you know, at the, just so, some dude made
at
it
the mall
in his back of his car. The kiosk. Yeah, totally. So I was dead set against it. I was like, no way. I'm not doing it. I was still, you know, so young and didn't know, you know, wrestling. I just thought it was like just a personal insult. And, you know storyline now, you know, if you look back, I've done a lot of other things worse than that. But then so I ended up wearing it. You know, I mean, I was mad. When Eddie suggested to me, I was throwing chairs in the back.
I remember. He was trying to explain to you, but both of us were like, dude, this is for your character. But you, I think at this point, it's once again, you're trying to make your way. Plus, maybe you and Eddie are on each other's nerves. Sure. Plus, WCW was such a crazy place anyways. I remember you throwing chairs. This is stupid. I hate this stupid thing. I'm not wearing this.
Well, I did it. I did it anyways. I said, okay, let me go ahead and do it. And that shirt got over. You know how many people actually
started making their own?
They wanted those shirts. And, you know, of course, WCW didn't cash in on it. Yeah. I mean, they would have made a killing. Eddie Guerrero's my favorite wrestler. I mean, and you know, really, he really was one of my favorite wrestlers, but it was just, you know, just like the, just being, you know, slice of humble pie, you know?
Yes.
It was just it was a good time.
You know, it's how, I mean, how was it growing up in the Guerrero family? I mean, from the day you're born, you're basically destined to be a wrestler.
Bro, growing up, the Guerrero family was like unlike any other, man. Not only did we have a wrestling ring in the backyard, you know, we learned to walk in a ring. We crawled in a ring, you know. Me and Eddie would take off the top rope so that the second rope was our top rope because we were small, you know. And we were jumping off our second rope, which is the top rope to us. And just, you know, that was great. But it's always like, it was like a pay-per-view. Every holiday was like a pay-per-view. You had your opening match, your opening fight, you know. You had your
at Christmas dinner or something.
Yeah, for sure. Thanksgiving
Mondo versus Hector.
Yeah. Then you had your mid card, and then you had your main event. You know, my dad against some, or my grandma going off, and so, you know, it was.
Was your grandfather still alive?
Oh yeah, I knew him very well. He died he passed away when I was 18.
And this is the legendary Gory Guerrero, father of Eddie and grandfather of Chavo.
Right.
What was he like?
You know, I saw a really great guy. He was already older by the time I came around, you know, so he was very, you know, very humble guy, very loving, so loving, very God-fearing man, you know, just a religious guy. And I didn't see the butt kicker that everybody knew. He, for some, you know, background on him, he supposedly was, you know, the toughest guy in Mexican wrestling. Mm-hmm. I mean, back then, being the heel that he was, the Rudo, he would go up to the stands and challenge people before his match. And he would slap people, and people hated him so much so that they shot at him in the ring.
Wow.
They actually shot at him in the ring, and he moved one time, and the lady got killed from a bullet. That's how much heat, you know.
Really?
Yeah, that's the truth. And, like, one time, this is just an example. I was a kid, and I was watching TV or something at his house. You know, we were always there. And I remember seeing, you know, somebody on TV got stabbed. You know, it was like a show. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, man, getting stabbed. That must hurt. And my grandfather goes, no, not really. It doesn't really hurt too bad. I was like, hold on. I couldn't grasp that this guy, he's my grandpa. Then he's telling me, no, getting stabbed is not really that big of a deal. And I'm like, what? Well, how many times have you been stabbed? He's like, oh, I've been stabbed about 7 times. And I was like, what?
It's a no big deal.
In gang fights or something? He's like, no. And not in gang fights. Literally just walking down the streets, and people hated him that much.
They would attack him on the street.
They'd attack him. And, you know, you can't beat him. Mm-hmm. So they would try to stab him. And
Amazing how things have changed. You know, back then you could really honestly get killed for being such a hated heel.
Yeah.
You know, I remember, I had the tail end of it in 2008 when I was the heel with the suit and tie. I got attacked a couple times.
Right.
One time in Victoria where there was a big brouhaha going on. But people used to get so angry. But I can just imagine back in those days, because they didn't know. There was no internet or stooge sheets or dirt sheets.
People believed, they really, really believed that they want, you know, that these guys were just as hated as they were. And they were. My family especially was so good at getting heat like that they would have to literally fight their way back to the dressing room with chairs and stuff because the crowd would turn on them. And there's no security back then. There's no, you know, cops and, you know, the security guards at the ring. It just was them against the fans. No barricades. And they would have to sneak out the windows of the dressing rooms to get out, because people would, you know, if they knew what car you drove, they would kill, you know, key your car and destroy your car. And it was great, actually a pretty incredible time. You know, they believed it.
So when you grew up in California, and then did your father train you when you got in the business?
Yeah. He trained me for sure. My Uncle Mondo had a big deal.
Okay, because he was actually had a school.
Yeah. My Uncle Mondo for sure. My my real training, my hands-on was, you know, living with Eddie and going to WCW.
Because you came into WCW pretty early in your career, right? You hadn't wrestled much.
I probably only had 10 matches.
See, but you had the instincts just from growing up in the family.
Yeah, I could always do all the moves. I didn't know why I was doing them. You know what I mean? But I could do them as long as I had somebody that would kind of tell me why I was doing them. But, you know, I grew up with a wrestling ring, so I could always do backflips and hurricanranas and all that kind of stuff. But I just didn't know why I was doing them.
Right, where to put them.
Yeah, sure.
Well, like I said, right from the start in WCW, when I got there, you had some good skills. And then you started, much like Eddie and much like all of us, when you started figuring out your personality. I mean, you're a totally charismatic, funny guy. But when you first start, you don't know what the hell's going on. It's kind of like it's all of us.
Yeah.
When you started kind of opening the door, and I felt that Terry Taylor was really good for our gang. He understood a little bit more about what we could bring to the table than Sullivan did, Kevin Sullivan, who was the booker when I started
there.
See,
you see a different story, a different side of Terry. This is how I grew up in the business. You know, you grew up coming in, you know, first of all, I don't know how somebody gets into wrestling without growing up in it, because it's such an art form. It's so hard to learn, you know, for you guys to learn on, you know, by yourselves, really, no one really teaching you. That's pretty incredible. But with me, I came in and I got two kinds of the guys that had been around for a long time. There's two kinds that were there. There were the kinds that were my family's friends that would take care of me. And there was the guys that really didn't like my family that would try to bury
take
me.
It out on you.
And Terry was one of those guys. You know, I remember this guy, he was trying to help me, but he wouldn't. You know, here's a story. So my, this is why, you know, I didn't get liked a lot. You know, I had a lot of bridges to cross, you know. So my dad and my uncle Hector are wrestling for Bill Watts, and they were in Houston at the time. And Terry was the helping booking, you know. Terry was the helping booking. Well, he told my uncle Hector and my dad, like, hey, you guys have to, you know, do a job. Somebody, you guys have to lose to somebody. And they're like, nah, we're not going to. Yeah. We're not going to do that. But Terry's like, you have to. He said, we're not going to do that. That's stupid. We're not going to do that. Tell us why. Well, because I said. And my dad and Hector are like, well, who are you? What do you mean? You're an assistant booker and you're going to tell us? They're like, well, Terry goes, if you don't do it, you're fired. So they're like, all right. Hey guys, to the whole, and he did, this is right in front of, you know, all the boys in the locker room. Said, okay, I guess Terry said we're fired. Okay, we'll see you guys later. So they walked out. They call up Bill Watts, the booker, the owner of the
boss.
Company, the boss, and goes, hey, Terry just fired us. And Bill's like, you guys aren't fired. Terry can't fire. Just come back tomorrow. Okay, so my dad and Hector come back the next day, and in front of, you know, the boys, and Terry's there and everybody, they start doing the dance like, hey guys, we're back. Terry can't fire us. And they're going back and forth to each other, like ring around the rose.
Yeah,
we're not fired. You have no power. You're not the booker. You're not as big as you think you are. So no wonder the guy hated me. You know what
right.
I mean?
I mean,
I was just some kid walking in. I was just this young guy, you know.
They will take it out on him.
Yeah,
now.
But I saw it, you know, time and time again. I got the guys that took care of me, that really looked out for me, like Tonga and, you know.
Haku,
yeah. And all those kind of guys, you know, that you know, Stan Hansen and all those guys that were you know, this huge in the business that took care of me. And then I saw the guys that, you know,
that
would
want
to bury me and would kill me. Yeah.
I remember when Bret Hart came into WCW, Terry came in one day and was giving him a finish or something. And when he left the room, Bret was kind of sitting there like confused. And he's like, wait a second. You mean to tell me the Red Rooster is calling the shots now?
Yeah, exactly. But nothing against Terry.
No, good guy.
Good guy. Get along with this. It's just a story we're telling in there.
Sure, you know, of course. Good guy. I can see why that animosity would come. The sins of the father, right?
Absolutely.
You know, and especially when, like we were talking about, I didn't finish my thought about the Indian caste system. We were in our gang, and it was almost like high school. If you sat down in catering with somebody like the Hogans, they would almost like get up and walk away. So we were really on our own. There wasn't like a group of veterans.
Right.
I remember like Arn was pretty cool and Jimmy Hart was cool, but that's about it from what I can remember as far as the guys that would actually help you there. Kurt Hennig.
Yeah, so we saw what was cool. We saw the Hennings, the Nords, and all those guys. They didn't believe in the hype. They just wanted to hang out and party with you.
Yeah,
and, you know, we could bring in the young bitches, you know. so they wanted us to bring in the young chicks and hang out with us, you know, and take us out and hang out with us.
How crazy was that? We would film, there was a show called WCW Worldwide, and we would film it probably once every 4 months for 2 weeks in Orlando. So we'd be there for 2 weeks straight. And it wouldn't be any of the top guys. It would just be all the guys like us and the Armstrongs and the Regals and, you know, whoever. All the kind of like the guys that would show up for Worldwide. And it was right in Disney, and there was a place called Downtown Disney, Pleasure Island.
Yeah, that was
and
great.
We used to go
eight tracks.
We used to go there every night and stay all night. And then you would go the next day and have to
work. You had to be at work. We had to be at work at 9 o'clock in the morning. Our tapings were like, you know, from 11 till 2 or whatever. They did like four shows. And then we'd all leave, go work out, and then go out again at night.
That's
right. We did that for two or three straight weeks.
And if you watched Worldwide, if you were a fan of that in the 90s, 50 to 60% of the guys you saw on TV were either hungover or still drunk.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, including us. Hey, a lot of fun. I mean, growing up in that time, there was no time in wrestling like that, especially for us, just hanging out with, you know, the new guys, the guys that have been there a while, and some of the older guys that were, you know, that we'd seen growing up, and now we're hanging out with them.
Well, the roster was so big, too. Like we said, like for the Worldwide tapings, there would be 100 guys there.
Yeah.
And you'd see them. I remember Lanny Poffel worked in WCW for a year and a half, and I never saw him once.
Never saw him.
And Horace Boulder was another one.
There was guys, when we did those pay-per-views, remember the World War III?
Yes.
World War III.
60 guys.
No, it's 90 guys. Three rings, and it was 30 men in each ring, a battle royal.
Yeah.
And there was still guys on the roster that didn't make the show.
That's right. 90 still guys.
90, not including the other matches. There was, what, like 150 guys in a concert?
How crazy is that?
No wonder they went under out of business.
Guys like, you know, like Bobby Blaze, Lenny Lane, the Colorado Kid, like you'd never even see these guys, and they were in there making
the gamblers.
Gambler.
All cool guys, man. I remember we'd party with those guys like crazy. We see those guys; they're still some of our boys, you know.
Yeah,
it's just like they had so many people on the contract. It was weird.
It was funny too. I remember when you started. We were talking about your personality when the whole Pepe thing started.
Yeah.
Pepe was your. That's what happened. Eddie Guerrero is my favorite wrestler. Then it kind of made you go nuts, right?
I went crazy. Yeah,
yeah.
And then we went to. That's another thing that I get asked about all the time is Pepe.
Yeah.
So we went to Eddie's house for a little barbecue, and, you know, Fit Finley was there, and, you know, Benoit and other people.
Dave Taylor and Regal.
Yeah. So, you know, we're all hanging out there with the barbecue, and I was going kind of crazy at the time, and his kids come out with this stick horse, like, riding it around, and we're like, oh, cool. Hey, you know what? We were in Tampa the next day, and that's where Eddie lived. So I go, you know what? Let me borrow that. I'm going to come out to the ring with this thing, and they're like, yeah, that'll be good. You're kind of going crazy. Okay, so I did it, and then the next week I didn't come out with it, and there was all no joke. There was all these Pepe signs and, you know, stick horses and stuff, and I was like, oh damn. Now I. And everybody's like, well, I guess you got to ride the stick horse all the time. I'm like, are you kidding me?
It's amazing.
I ribbed myself. And so I had a word. I had to use this stick horse all the time. Remember the story with us?
This is great. We were working each other. I don't know. It seemed like every week.
Yeah.
And I was a heel, and you were a babyface. Crazy Chavo got over as baby, and Pepe was over, like you said.
Yeah.
And they were had us work
the same match. Same every match.
And it was the same finish.
Yeah, yeah.
I would beat you. With the lion tamer.
I don't know how many times you beat me. Like 100.
And making the babyface tap out. Like, I'm the heel. How does that help me? And nobody. Yeah. And here's the thing too. This is what is crazy about WCW. Is that in WWE, there's a whole backstage area behind the curtain.
Right.
It's called the gorilla position. Yep. That's where Vince is. They're watching the show, monitoring everything.
Yep.
In WCW, it was a curtain and nothing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You'd have Jody Hamilton keeping time like 30 feet down from the rampway.
Tell those guys to go home.
Go home. Right.
I said tell those son of a – go home.
Right. So we're like – we show up and we're in Fargo. And it's Chavo versus Chris, and Chris is over with a submission. I'm like, this sucks.
Yeah.
So we went to Toys R Us.
That's right.
And we bought a big aluminum baseball bat.
Okay, first of all, you can never, ever do this in WWE. Just book your own stuff and just do your own stuff. We just went, okay, we're going to do something different. So we went and bought a big aluminum baseball bat and another Pepe.
And a big horse head. Another Pepe. And taped it to the baseball bat, right?
Taped him to the baseball bat and put him underneath the ring.
We went back to the Fargo Dome and we went and snuck it underneath the ring. And once again, nobody knows we're doing this.
Yeah.
We didn't tell anybody. Nobody knew. Nobody cares.
Yeah.
We do the match.
Yep.
And I beat you.
Yeah, I think you did beat me, didn't you? I don't know if you did. I think you're about ready to. You threw me out of the ring, and then you broke Pepe.
That was it. Yeah, okay. I said to Terry, what are we going to do different? He goes, well, break Pepe. Okay, so I'm going to beat the babyface, have him submit clean, and break his gimmick.
Yeah.
So we're like,
My stick horse gimmick.
Your stick horse. All right, so we did that. I broke broke Pepe. Yeah. Chavo goes under the ring and grabs Pepe's older brother, Jose.
Yeah.
It's a big, giant aluminum baseball bat with a horse head on it.
and came in, and then Chris turns around, and I nailed him across the chest, wham, boom. And then rode around in the stick course.
On Jose.
On Jose. And then the next week, I don't know if you remember, the next week, they did a recap of last week, the next week on SmackDown, or like the previews for, you know, what's coming up this week. They did a preview or like a recap from the last week, and it says, and that made the recap. Chavo killed Jericho. And it shows me hitting him with this big old baseball bat and then riding around the ring. And of course, they didn't do anything with it, but it was just like, that's what happened.
But the thing is, nobody knew. Yeah. We came back. Nobody said a word. No one made any comments. No. We literally went and built our own prop and hid it under the ring and used it. Yep. And nobody said a thing. Can you imagine doing that in the WWE? You would be fired on the spot. Vince would run down to the ring and punch you in the face during the match.
I can imagine Vince at the gorilla position with his glasses and them coming down and looking at the agent like, Dean, did you tell him to do this? Yeah. What do you mean you'll know about this, Dean?
When Vince gets mad, he'll pull his bifocals down and stare at you just with his eyes. Yeah. Dean, you didn't know about this?
He probably would have fired the agent too.
Oh, everybody. And you know, fired the guys at the who set up the ring for not checking underneath the ring for a prop.
Right.
But that's just how it was at WCW. Yeah. It was living in kind of the Wild West and doing what you could. Yeah. And that's why we stuck together as our gang with Eddie, Chris, Dean, you and me. And I want to talk more about that and talk about Chris and Eddie. You were with them basically towards the last few days, last day even.
Right, for sure.
Of their lives. And you know, that's why I wanted to talk to you about it, because you were like, you know, you understood more than anybody what Chris and Eddie were all about.
Sure.
And great guys. We love them very much. I love this guy right here. This is Chavo Guerrero, my buddy.
Yeah, man.
Una pincha ghost.
Peachy ghost. The peachy ghost story. That was awesome. You want to tell that story real quick?
Yeah, tell it.
Okay, real quick. So we're in Japan, Chris and I, and we're with like a few other people, like Dr. Wagner Jr. and Scorpio Jr. And, you know, when you go to Japan and wrestle on the Japanese tour, there's like three or four or five gaijins, the foreigners, you know. So we all kind of hang out together and stuff. So, you know, Chris, traveling everywhere, he can you know, he can speak a lot of languages. He can speak Japanese pretty well and write Japanese and speak very good Spanish. So we're talking to one of the Mexican wrestlers, Scorpio Jr.
Yeah.
And we're at drinking sushi or something like this. Drinking sake. You know, we're all just hanging out at the after party. Because you're on tour for like 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And you're working every night. And you really band together as friends, you know. And especially people you don't even know. You just you're with each other 24/7 that you're just, you know, you hang out all the time.
Your family.
So then we're talking and we're in this hotel that was supposedly haunted. And we're trying to explain to Scorpio Jr., who's Mexican.
You're trying to explain.
We were all trying to explain to Scorpio Jr., who is Mexican.
Pure Mexican. Doesn't speak a word of English.
Any English. And we're trying to tell him that there's it's haunted in there, in this supposedly this little small hotel. So Chris is trying to tell him, hey, man, so there's a
phantasm
or
something.
There's a ghost in here, and he's speaking in Spanish, but he doesn't know the word for ghost. And sure enough, I come in, you know, the Latino guy's like, oh, hey, don't worry, Chris. Let me take this.
The Chino.
So I go, hey, wait. And I'm talking the same thing that Chris just said in the hotel. I want a peachy ghost. So instead of saying, hey, there's this, you know, phantasma or whatever, you know, Casper or whatever. I said, yeah, the same thing he just said. There's this ghost.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let me take this. Let me explain ghost to him.
And that's the hotel and a pinch of ghost. And pinch is kind of like slang. So that's what you added to it. Yeah. The guy's still staring at us.
Yeah. He's still staring at
us. Pinch of ghost. Do you remember the orange?
I remember you looked at me like, I just said that.
That's
what
I said. Oh, because you're Spanish.
Yeah,
you get it?
Yeah, you get it. See,
I said you live in California your whole life. I speak better Spanish than you.
Exactly.
Do you remember the orange?
Yeah, we used to pass it back and forth.
We had this stupid orange in Japan that I drew a face on. And this is what you do when you're on the road for like weeks. You start getting stir crazy. It would just be a game to see how you could put the orange into the other guy's bag without the guy noticing.
You snuck it in my bag first. Like, we were looking at the stupid orange. I don't know. I think you put a face on it. And next thing you know, I get home or I get to my hotel room and the orange is in my bag.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, he got me. Okay. So like the next night, and this was not even planned. The next night we were in some other town and I snuck the orange back into his bag.
That's right. Yeah.
But he couldn't find it. If he would have found it that day. So you got to wait till the end of the night to do it. So if he would have found it, he would have put it back in my bag. So I snuck it back in his bag. And then vice versa. We went, what, months?
Yeah, it lasted through a few tours. It started getting all dry and hard.
Yeah. It looked like a tennis ball.
Do you remember when you came to drop it off in my room?
No, I don't remember.
There was a girl there?
Uh-uh.
Some like naked girl answered the door and you gave her the orange.
I'm sure an extremely hot naked.
This girl was
so,
this girl was a 12.
She was so hot.
She was she was part of the Swedish soccer team.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. So I think I knocked the door right and gave, hey, give this to Chris. He left this. Yeah. What? Yeah. So then I got you with. So this naked girl, I could. What happened? This incredibly hot naked girl comes and knocks it and goes, hey, this is yours.
No, you came to drop. Is that what happened?
I don't remember. I gave it to her, right?
Yeah, you gave it to her, and when I came back, she gave me this orange that you had dropped off. We'll be back with more Talk is Jericho and more Chavo Guerrero after a few words from our amazing sponsors.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Talk is Jericho.
Welcome back to Talk is Jericho. I'm here with my bro, Chavo Guerrero. Amazing, amazing history that we've had. We've known each other for, man, it's almost 20 years now, 18 years. Yeah. Traveled the roads.
How can that be? Because we're only 21 years
old. I know,
old.
It's crazy. At least in our heads we are.
Yeah.
Spent so much time together on the road, not just in WCW, but also in WWE as well. Yeah. And then suddenly the six-passenger van, went down to the four of us, five of us, you, me, Dean, Eddie, and Chris. Yeah. And then I think we ended up on different shows. And you went through this amazing phase with it was you and Eddie were a tag team.
Yep.
And you would work against Chris and Edge or Chris and Rey Mysterio
Angle. Yeah.
It was like the six of you guys. And I talked about this with Edge for SmackDown in the summer of 2003 or 4, whatever it was. And every match was just a classic match. You know, it was just a great time.
Calling us the SmackDown Six.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was fun.
I mean, and you and Eddie had great chemistry at that point. You'd come into your own as heels or as baby faces, kind of as riding in the lolos and all that sort of thing. Then basically, were you guys working together when Eddie passed away, or was he already kind of on his own?
No, he'd already been the heavyweight champion, and I'd already turned on him, and I was doing the cruiserweight thing, you know. So,
how did you feel when he became the champion?
Well, our dream as kids we never pretended we were the heavyweight champions of the world. We always pretended we were the tag team champions of the world. We would get my dad's and my uncle's, you know, tag team belts and wear them around the house as kids and pretend, you know, in the backyard ring that we were the champions and stuff. So that was our goal, was to be the world tag team champions. And we achieved that in, you know, 2002 at a Survivor Series, and we won it at all places, Madison Square Garden, and became the WWE tag team champions. So after you do that goal, you have to make new goals.
Mm-hmm.
So we really made the goals to be both heavyweight champions. So when that actually, you know, you got to understand, this is a big man's business. It really is. This is a big Caucasian man's business. Mm. It really is. And for us to be two short, small, brown guys, you know, being their heavyweight champions, it's a big step, and it's a big lofty goal to set for oneself. So for Eddie to achieve that, man, it's like we all did. It's like every guy under 6 foot, you know, 200 pounds became the champion and really was. And for me, I was just so happy for him. You know, I mean, that night, I think I won the Cruiserweight Championship. It was at Cow Palace. I beat Rey Mysterio for the Cruiserweight Championship. But me and Eddie were still feuding. So when he won the Heavyweight Championship
from Brock Lesnar,
he walked back through the curtain, and everybody's congratulating him, and all the cameras were on him. And I wanted so much to go up to him. I just couldn't because of the storyline. We really stuck true to those storylines. We wouldn't ride together or nothing. We wouldn't even really kind of talk to each other at the shows.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but when we got in the dressing room, man, I hugged him, and it was elated for him. Mm-hmm. And then the very next night, I believe in Fresno or San Jose, they challenged him for his heavyweight championship. I was the Cruiserweight champion. I came out saying, hey, you know what? I won the Cruiserweight champion, and nobody cared. But now you win the Cruiserweight championship, and I mean, you win your heavyweight championship, and there's a freaking parade, and you get
you were glitter. Like the jealous younger brother.
Yeah, exactly. You know, which played perfect into the story.
Yeah,
the story, you know. But we were just so happy for him, man.
And was he starting to feel a lot of pain at that point in time?
You know what? He felt the weight of the company on his shoulders.
Absolutely.
And that's Eddie always, it was very hard for him. He wore his heart on his sleeve no matter what. If he loved you, he would literally take his shoes off of his feet and give them to you. Mm-hmm. And this is no joke. I've seen him do it. Mm-hmm. I saw him do it and give somebody that didn't have shoes, gave him his workout shoes. Here you go.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not kidding you. Mm-hmm. But if he hated you, if he didn't like you, you knew it too. There was no, you know, there was no pretending. He didn't.
He wasn't fake.
He wasn't fake at all. If he didn't like you, you'd know that too. Well, you know, he felt the weight of the world on his shoulders. You know, if you're the heavyweight champion of WWE or of any company, really, you're there because you're the ones putting the butts in the seats, the asses in the seats, as we call it.
Mm-hmm.
You are the main guy in the company to draw the most money. And that's typically how it's been, you know. And so Eddie really felt that. We're old school. You know, that's the way it was forever. Your biggest drawer was your champ. Now, you know, it may not be that way at times. But, you know, it really was. And he felt that. He
would feel like, I remember, if the houses were down, yes. If you went to, like, you know, Chicago, and last time there was a $300,000 house, and this time there was a $285,000,
right.
Eddie would take that personally and think it was him, and he was the reason why, and he would get really down about that.
Yeah, I would have talks with him and say, dude, this is not 15 years ago. It's not the company based around one guy anymore.
It's the name brand.
It's not, you know, Hulk Hogan versus Andre the Giant on the marquee anymore. It's WWE on the marquee. It's, you know, Vince was smart enough to change that and make it about the company, not about two guys.
Yes.
And I told Eddie that. It's not just you anymore. You may be, you know, quarterback, and they may try to give you the ball, but, you know, they're not letting you just run straight with it and go to town. So you got to give it time. You just became champion.
Mm-hmm.
You have to give it time for those numbers to come up. He felt it very, very much. He saw it.
He was a real sensitive guy.
Absolutely.
You know, I remember one time there was one guy in the crowd that said, Eddie sucks. And, you know, there's always going to be those guys. And he was the baby face at the time. And the guy was given, I remember he grabbed the mic and he was like, you shut your mouth. I don't care what you think. You think I suck? And it's like, dude, it's one guy out of 10,000. Yeah. Don't even listen to him.
No,
screw that guy. F that guy. He's in my face, man. He really got so excited and so overwhelmed by these things.
Bro, I remember one time we were in Canada, and it was us, the Guerreros, Los Guerreros, against the Basham brothers.
Uh-huh.
And I was in the ring selling against one of the other Bashams, and Eddie was outside. They were fighting with somebody else. So I'm in the ring where all the action is, where everybody's watching, and it was quiet. And all of a sudden, I hear a big eruption. I'm like, what the heck's going on? There shouldn't be this eruption right now. People shouldn't be going crazy. I look outside and I see Eddie. He's chasing some guy in the crowd. He's chasing the guy going up. And I was like, what's going on? What's going on? So then as I get out there, Eddie's like, the guy, I was out there selling and some guy poured beer on him.
Mm-hmm.
When he was on the ground, the guy looked at his friend, kind of like shook shrugged his shoulders and poured beer on Eddie. Well, Eddie is a recovering alcoholic.
Oh.
So Eddie chased the guy down, and then he came back. He grabbed the mic and he looked at the people and said, I'm very sorry. This is in the middle of the match. He grabbed the mic and said, I'm very sorry. That was wrong. I'm a Christian. I shouldn't have done that.
Wow.
But I'm also a recovering alcoholic. And he threw it in my face and dropped beer all over me.
Yeah.
And he goes, that was like just a complete insult. I should have never got out of character.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just in the middle of a match.
Right.
And right when that happened, I'm like, how do we get this back? How do we get this match back? I looked at the Bashams and I go, jump us. Jump us. I kind of whispered to them. And they jumped us and, whoa, we had the heat right there again and just went right back into the match. It was perfect. But that's the kind of guy he was.
And it's like you said, too, he had so many issues over the years with alcohol and with pills and stuff. And he'd, you know, I was in the dressing room when they carted him out and took him straight to rehab in Minneapolis when he fell asleep.
Right.
Finally, he had gotten over that, at least as far as I knew. I mean, I don't know.
He was.
It seemed like he was pretty legit, clean, and sober.
4 years sober, bro.
4 years sober.
When he died,
And then he passed away from enlarged heart.
Heart failure at 38 years old.
Do you think that's because of all the drugs that caught up to him?
Absolutely. They say, you know, because of – you've seen it time and time again. In this business, the worst drugs, and I don't care what they are, it's not, you know – steroids, it's not alcohol, it's not cocaine, it's not marijuana. The worst things are the pills.
Mm-hmm.
You see, everybody that we know that have died has been from those pills.
That's true, yeah.
It's a quick release. We're hurt. It's easy for us to, you know, it's easy to us to justify using that because if anybody needs them, you know, we need them. need a Vicodin. We need this. But then it's so easy to start abusing that stuff. And that's where, you know, that was Eddie's vice. So, you know, he fought every day to stay off those. You know, he really did. But they say with, you know, Vicodins and Somas and all that stuff was that it gives a lot of scar tissue on your heart. Mm. Because you abuse them so much. And we've seen it with Umaga and so many different people who died from heart failure and heart troubles and because of those pills, you know. So that's kind of what happened to him, you know. And the story, really, he and I were – we were flying to Minneapolis. We were all home. This is the first day of the tour. And we were going to Europe.
Was it a pay-per-view in Minneapolis?
It was a dual show, like a SmackDown and Raw.
Oh, because you're going to Europe.
Yeah, yeah, doing both shows in Minneapolis, and then we're going to go straight to Europe. So everybody was there. So I get on the plane. Eddie had already moved to Phoenix. Mm-hmm. So I get on the plane, and I'm in coach, and he's, you know, in first class. Well, I get on and I'm a coach. The door's getting ready to close. And I see Eddie, you know, he was always the last one. He was on Mexican time always, you know. And I say
shoulders slumped.
Yeah, yeah. And I say that with all, you know, due respect. Yeah, of course. Everybody knows Mexican time. Mexican time is. Yeah. So he runs on the plane, right before the door's closed. And he gets on. And I go, hey. And he goes, hey, what's up, man? I didn't know you were going to be on this plane. So he gives up his first class seat and comes back with me. So we hung out and stayed together. It was like just a treat, you know, it really was to sit next to each other. And we were on different shows at the time, so we didn't see each other all that much.
Right.
So we sat next to each other and we were watching a movie, you know, and he looks at me and he's talking and stuff, and he kind of nods off as he's talking to me. I say, oh, man, he's really tired, you know. And then he kind of wakes up and like, oh, hey, you know, and kind of goes, you know, we went up watching a movie together and we get to Minneapolis. I didn't think anything of it. We get to Minneapolis and we go to check in at one of the Marriott.
Yeah, the one by the airport.
By the Target Center. No, the one by the Target Center.
Oh, okay.
That everybody was staying at. So we go there and, you know, and I was like, hey, man, we used to room together, you know, all the time. And we decide, hey, you know, we'll just get our own rooms. Okay, no problem. So we're checking in and As we're there, we see Michael Hayes. Michael Hayes comes up to us, and he's not Michael Hayes anymore. He's Freebird.
Mm.
He's the Freebird. He's been drinking and hanging out.
He's the beer wolf.
Yeah, yeah. And he kind of mad dogs Eddie, you know. And I didn't really notice it, but, you know, Eddie.
What do you mean, mad dog?
Mad dogs. He kind of stared him down.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah.
Stared him down, but, you know, I didn't really notice it, and after Michael leaves, goes back to the bar, Eddie stops and looks at me and goes, did you see what that mofo did? So what do you mean? Yeah, he's staring at me. I'm like staring at you? Like, he's like, yeah, Eddie's pissed. And I said, all right, what do you want to do? You want to go beat him up? Because we were just, you know, if he's going to get a fight, I'm going to get a fight, and vice versa. So he's like, nah, we'll give him a pass. I said, okay. So we literally gave him a pass. So the night before Eddie died, really, I mean, Michael Hayes didn't know how close he was to getting beat up. I'm literally, we were going to go in there and drag him out, beat him up. So we said, okay, hey, man, well, let's... why don't we, you know, go work out in the morning? And just as we got there, we see Chris Benoit. Mm-hmm. And Benoit goes, hey, man, what's up, guys? Hey, we're going to bed, but we're going to train 8 a.m. Just meet down for breakfast, 8 a.m. We'll go train before the show. We always did. And then we're going to go to Target Center. Okay, great. No problem. So I go to my room. Eddie goes to his room. Well, then I get a call from Eddie, my cell phone. He says, hey, man, can I talk to you? And I say, yeah, what's going on, man? And he goes, I got to talk to you. I said, okay, hold on. Let me run downstairs real quick. You know, let me take care of some stuff downstairs. I don't know if I was, you know, getting an extra key or whatever I was doing. So I went downstairs and then I call Eddie to his room, you know, 5-8 minutes later. And I go, hey, man, you want to talk? And he goes, nah, I'm okay. I'm cool. Hmm. And I said, are you sure? Let's talk. And he goes, nah, I'm cool, man. I'm okay. I'm bro. I'm here. He's like, nah, I'm good. I said, all right, man, well, I'll see you in the morning. We'll go work out. Okay, cool. No problem. You know, I think I had a beer. Then went to bed. I was going to wake up and go work out. And at 7 a.m., I got a call from one of the security guards in the hotel. He says, Chavo. Yeah, hey, this is security in the hotel. I'm like, all right. Why are you calling me? He goes, well, your uncle is, I don't know how he knew we were there, or I was there. He wasn't there that night. I guess the word got around, whatever. And he goes, your uncle's passed out. I said, passed out? He goes, yeah, he's passed out in the bathroom. And I'm thinking, the bathroom? And we had just talked on the plane that Eddie was sober for 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, passed out? Did he have a relapse? Oh, no. Come on. Really?
But also, how would the guy know? It's 7 in the morning.
I was like, how? So he's passed out in the bathroom. I'm thinking he's passed out in the bathroom
in the lobby
or something like that. So I go, okay, I'll be right down. And the security guard goes, no, I'll come up to your room. So he comes up to my room. And he comes, gets me. I'm still half out of it, you know, and we got in late last night, the mm-hmm. night before. So I'm coming down, and he takes me to Eddie's room. I said, what do you mean his room? So I guess he explained to me that Eddie had missed a couple wake-up calls.
Yeah.
So they went to knock on his door, and the latch was on his door.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so whenever that happens, they're you know, knocking, no answer. They cut the latch off.
Mm.
So as I open up, the latch is already cut off. And I walk in, and I see Eddie face down in the bathroom.
Hmm.
He's face down. I mean, just like, and I looked at him, kind of like, still thinking. Well, wait a minute. I'm still coming to my senses. And I'd seen Eddie passed out from, you know, drinking or pills or whatever it was, you know, 20 times in my life.
Right.
But of course, this was years and years before.
Mm-hmm.
So when I looked at him, I'm like, anybody else? I mean, if I would have seen, you know, just any random person, I'd be like, you're passed out. What the heck? You know, let me get him up. So I see Eddie's down. I'm like, okay, let me assess the situation. What's going on? So I put my hand by his nose, and there's no breath, you know, but mm-hmm. I hear a couple gurgling noises. And then I go, this isn't right. I'm feeling him. He's warm. Hmm. You know, he's warm. He's not like, I'm like, okay, this isn't right. Let's pull him out. So I talked to the security guard, and we pull him out and turn him around. And so as soon as I see his face, when we turn around, I said, like, I start panicking. Okay, this really isn't right. Call 911 now. And so they're calling, you know, 911, and we're giving them, you know, mouth to mouth from CPR. Yeah. And you know, I'm freaking out. I'm yelling at him, going, Eddie, stay with me. Come on, Eddie, come on.
Basically, do you think he was still alive?
He was still alive because he was warm.
Wow.
And then I saw him go from warm to cold. He died right there.
Wow.
Right there. And, you know, they called 911, the, you know, ambulance came, and, you know, they're giving CPR and everything their way, you know, and they're just like, he's gone. And, oh, and I was like, what if I would have got here, you know, an hour before? And usually we room together.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't room together. And they're like, no, they said he had, you know, something already. He would have been gone no matter what. I'm like what?
Mm-hmm.
So now I'm sitting here with my brother dying basically in my arms
mm-hmm.
going, I was in shock. I was like in shock. And then I had to go back to my room and call people. I'm like, well, I didn't know who to call.
Who did you call?
I'm like, who do I call? I think I called home. I'm freaking out. I'm like, oh my God. So I called Fit Finley. Like,
why Fit and not Dean or Chris?
Well, I didn't want to wake up Chris. Fit was an agent.
Yeah.
So I want him to get the word to, you know, what's going on to Vince and everybody. I don't have Vince's cell phone, you know. I'm not like you. I wasn't the champ. So he goes around and makes some, you know, I get some calls, and all of a sudden I'm in my hotel room just sitting on the bed like what the heck just happened?
Mm-hmm.
And then I get a call from Chris Benoit. Goes, hey, where are you? I'm downstairs. We're supposed mm-hmm. to meet at 8 o'clock to go work out and eat breakfast. And I'm like, Chris, sit down. Are you sitting down? He goes, yeah. So I told Chris, and Chris was like, I never heard somebody wail like that. Like this deep moan. Like, oh, like I just, you know, mm-hmm. punched him in the stomach and
mm-hmm.
stole his soul.
Mm.
That's what it felt like, you know. And I was like, and he was yelling and screaming and just deep. Whoa, no. You know, so, and then from there, I mean, I had to go back to the room, and then Vince McMahon and Triple H, Shawn Michaels came over, and, you know, Vince is asking, what do I do? Do we go on with this show? And I was like, absolutely, you go on with this show. Mm-hmm. You don't cancel the show.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, you go on with the show. I go, that's what Eddie would have wanted to do. He wouldn't want everybody here. And Eddie knew, we were always taught that you always have to, you know, give the people their money's worth, mm-hmm. no matter what. They're there to see you. In this, you know, this economy, they don't have a lot of money, and they're choosing to spend it on you. It's your obligation to give them their money's worth.
Yeah.
It really, really is. So I looked at Vince. I said, yeah, if you cancel the show, then he'd be pissed. That's not what he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So they went ahead and made a tribute show to Eddie, you know, and I mean, completely rewritten, you know, totally different. But then, you know, that we had to deal with all that stuff and go to
Did you have to go to Europe, or were you able to do the funeral?
No, no. So I went. Yeah. You know, when we did that show, they said, "Of course, Chavo, we don't. You can go home." I said, "No, I want to wrestle." Mm-hmm. I was able to wrestle JBL, you know, and just
another good friend of Eddie.
Yeah, yeah, and that was just a great moment. But that night, who stayed behind from the tour was me, Chris Benoit, Rey Mysterio, and Dean Malenko. Mm-hmm. They let us all stay behind and take care of some stuff. Everybody flew out that night. We went back to the hotel and we're like, well, let's get something to eat. So we're eating. It's a very somber moment. And Zach Wilde showed up.
That's right.
So Zach comes up to us. Zach Wilde, the guitarist for Ozzy Osbourne and Black Label Society, and good friend of yours. And I'd never met him. And he goes, "Hey, what's up, guys? You just want to say, hey, I'm Zach. I'm a friend of Chris Jericho's and Steve Austin's and blah, blah, blah." And I'm not putting two and two together. I'm like, "Hey, man, what's up? How you doing?" And we didn't necessarily blow him off, but we weren't very receptive.
Yeah.
So then he went back to the bar and did his own thing. And then the next time I saw Zach, I came up to him and go, "Man, hey, man, I just want to apologize. When I met you that first time, Eddie had just passed that night and we were dealing with it." He's like, "We didn't know until we got back to the bus," whatever, and the word went around. Yeah. And we're like, he was like, "Oh, don't even worry about it. No wonder you guys didn't, were just kind of standoffish, you know?"
Yeah, absolutely. But Chavs, I mean, there's so much to talk about. We got to stop for this week. But next week, I want to hear more about this and talk about Chris Benoit. I know you were one of the guys that he was texting in the last few days of his life. I want to hear all about that. And I want to hear what you're doing these days, Chavo, and also what your favorite match of all time is. A few more stories of us traveling together. So much more to talk about with Chavo Guerrero. This is Talk is Jericho.
Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. And they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com, TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
Thanks to Chavo Guerrero, we'll have him back. But it's time to answer one of your questions as usual. And usually I take the questions on the Twitter, at Talk is Jericho. But today I decided to take a call instead. So we have Kellen on the line. What's your question, my friend? How you doing, Kellen?
Doing good. How about you, Chris?
I'm doing good, man. Where are you from?
I'm from Redlands, California.
All the way from Cali. All right. What's your question, my man?
Yeah, I was wondering, after listening to interviews with Edge and Bret Hart and how you guys have some good stories, why don't you guys ever try to become creative writers for WWE and work with them, considering they kind of need help right now with their stories?
That's a really good question. And I'll tell you, like, first of all, for me personally, I think my ego is too big to be behind the scenes. I like being in front of the camera. But I think another thing that a lot of people don't know is I think a lot of times the creative writers take a lot of heat and get a lot of trouble for, you know, WWE creative needs help or WWE creative isn't good. But a lot of times, I mean, they're writing ideas and working nonstop, but those ideas get changed quite a bit because it all depends on what Vince McMahon wants to do. And if he feels that he needs a change in direction, or if he feels that, you know, he could agree to something and then change his mind and change it again. So you could do a lot of long-term planning that gets changed constantly. So I think it's a very hard job to do. And it's also kind of really just flying by the seat of your pants and just holding on. And also the hours that they have to abide by are insane because Vince is busy. You know, Vince is late for meetings, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's a pretty thankless job. And I give anybody that works in creative for an extended amount of time a lot of credit. You know, guys there like Dave Kapoor and Brian Gewirtz and Ed Koski that have been there for 10 years plus, those guys deserve a lot of credit because it's not an easy job. So I couldn't take it. I'd be too hot-headed. I'd be yelling at Vince and I'd probably get fired in about a month.
Yeah.
All right, man.
I was always wondering about that. Thank you.
Oh, thanks for your call. I appreciate you listening and thanks for calling in, man. See, there you go. All the way from California. That was a good way to end off Talk is Jericho. I might have to do more live calls in the future. But thank you so much for listening today. We have Chavo Guerrero back, like I said. And also,
thanks for clicking on that Amazon banner every time you shop online. Remember, whenever you link to Amazon through my Talk is Jericho page, Amazon kicks back a little cash to the show so I can keep doing this for you for free. This is not cheap to do this show. I'm taking live calls. Do you know how much it costs to call long distance? It's expensive. So go to podcastone.com, click on Talk is Jericho, and then click on the Amazon banner. There's no hidden fees or charges. You don't have to do anything. Just make your normal purchases and help out Talk is Jericho. You still get the great Amazon prices and service. You just help me out in the process. Stay cool, stay hard, stay heavy, stay hungry. We'll see you soon. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Talk is Jericho. Don't forget, every Wednesday there's a brand new episode of Talk is Jericho at podcastone.com.